Mr. Richard Becker from the ANSA Coalition joining us from San Francisco. Also, thanks to journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas, who's with us from the British capital, London. Also, thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul in تخفوا ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض وَاللَّهُ عَلَى كُلِّ شَيْءٍ قَدِيرٌ يَوْمَ تَجِدُ كُلُّ نَفْسٍ مَا عَمِلَتْ مِنْ خَيْرٍ مُحْضَرًا وما عملت من سوء تود لو أن بينها وبينه أمدا بعيدا ويحذركم الله نفسه والله
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it. And He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth. And Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: one Palestinian man is killed and two others injured by Israeli gunfire near the West Bank city of Nablus. A cybersecurity firm reveals that a recent ransomware attack on a U.S. IT company potentially targeted 1,000 businesses. And at least 17 people are killed after a military plane with 85 personnel on board crashed in southern Philippines.
Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi.
A Palestinian man has been killed near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. 21-year-old Mohammad Farid was shot dead by Israeli forces during clashes in the village of Kasra. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandel, has more details.
The settlers from the nearby settlement Yesh. It's close to the Palestinian village of Kusra, south Nablus and northern the occupied West Bank. They raided the village and started attacking people in their homes, throwing stones and even using fire against the people in their homes. That's why Palestinians left their homes in order to defend their land, their homes, and themselves as well. The clashes erupted between the settlers and the Palestinians there. Then the Israeli military raided the village of Kusra in order to protect the settlers. Not only this, but also attack the people. Israeli forces fired live ammunition towards the Palestinians, the residents of Kusra. Mohammed Farid Hassan, 21-year-old, was one of the Palestinians who were trying to protect their homes and themselves. According to our sources in the village of Kusra, Mohammed Hassan was at the top of his, at the roof of his home, while he was shot in the chest. The Israeli forces then took him with them. Then they declared that he succumbed to his injuries. Up till the moment, the body of Muhammad is still with the Israeli army. The Israeli military are claiming that he was one of the people throwing Molotov cocktails at the Israeli forces. We are speaking about two more Palestinians were wounded during these clashes.
Israeli fighter jets have bombed two positions in the north of Gaza Strip. Our correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon, joined us earlier with the latest on the incident.
Israeli fighter jets attacked two security posts that belong to Hamas's military wing, the Zdin Hassan Brigades, one south of Gaza City. I mean, I saw that with my own eyes. I was sitting on the roof of one of my friend's homes, and I saw that the area lit up with like hellfire. The second attack happened in northern Gaza, and causing extensive damage to both sites and also surrounding areas. We have to understand that Gaza is around 360 square kilometers and has 2 million people, at least 2 million people living in it. Among them, nearly 60% are people people under the age of 18. So every time the Israeli regime fires a rocket or shoots a bullet towards the enclave, it's likely to hit, maim, or kill someone. We've been hearing witnesses in the areas of the second bombing in northern Gaza saying they think someone was seriously injured or possibly died because of the attack, but we're still waiting for the Ministry of Health to confirm such scenario if it happened.
Meanwhile, Israel says one of its cargo ships has been attacked in the Indian Ocean while en route to the United Arab Emirates. The ship was identified as Tindal, a Liberian-flagged cargo ship, which is under partial Israeli ownership. Israeli media say the vessel was possibly hit by a missile. Reports said the crew were not hurt. The ship, though, was not badly damaged either. Media reports cited Israeli sources who claim that Iran was behind the incident. In the past months, a number of Israeli ships have been targeted in waters around the world. The regime usually puts the blame for such incidents on Iran, but Tehran has vehemently rejected any involvement. Political commentator Kevin Barrett says that it wouldn't be surprising if the attack on the Israeli vessel was a retaliatory one, considering recent Israeli acts of sabotage against Iran.
You know, we never really know what's happening with these kinds of incidents, because often the people behind them are doing a deniable kind of operation. They can be false flag operations. They could be carried out by independent groups, or it could, of course, be part of an alleged ongoing tit-for-tat kind of thing in which Israel has actually been the aggressor, going after shipping related to Iran. And in particular, Israel is doing everything it can to try to prevent Syria from remaining part of the axis of resistance, because the Zionists are expansionists. They want to keep stealing territory. They want to keep the Golan Heights and grab more territory if they can. And as this strong axis of resistance emerges that's telling them, no, your days are numbered, they're panicking. And one of the things the Israelis have done is target Iranian ships. So it wouldn't be surprising if there were some Iranian retaliation, but we don't know if that's the case. Again, it could be independent groups, and it could even be a false flag, although I doubt this would be a false flag if we see the Israelis doing something that they really wanted to do anyway, immediately thereafter, and then using this as an excuse, then we might suspect that it's a false flag.
The Russian military says terrorists are planning to carry out false flag chemical attacks in Syria's northern province of Idlib. Earlier, we discussed this matter in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Russian military says terrorists are planning a false flag chemical attack in Syria's Idlib province. The Russian Center for the Reconciliation of Opposing Parties in Syria said the terrorists have delivered 10 barrels of toxic substances to an area near the village of Harim. It said terrorists and the White Helmets, a group operating under the guise of aid work in Syria, have been involved in the delivery. According to the report, the terrorists are planning to blame the Syrian government for the attack. Now, Syria has been gripped by foreign-backed militancy since 2011. Damascus says Israel and its Western and regional allies are aiding the Takfiri terrorist groups that are wreaking havoc in the country. I'd like to welcome my guests to this news review. Out of Damascus, Muhammad Ali, and out of Ontario, Robert Fantina, author and journalist. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let me start it off with Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali, give us an overall review on what is going on and what is being said about this possible false flag attack.
Yes, deputy head of the Russian Coordination Center, which is based in Hmeymim, a Russian air base in Syria, said that they received information recently that terrorists of the Al-Nusra Front are planning, in cooperation with the so-called White Helmets, to carry out a false flag chemical attack and then accuse the Syrian army in the de-escalation zone of Idlib. Now, according to Vadim Kolet, the Russia's deputy head of the coordination center there in Hmeymim, he said that terrorists from the Al-Nusra Front, accompanied by other terrorists from the so-called White Helmets, transported about 10 barrels of toxic and poisonous substances via trucks to an area called Harim in Idlib in order to carry out such a fabrication about a chemical attack over there in Idlib, particularly in the southern part of the Al Zawiya mountain, and then accused the Syrian army. This is definitely not the first time that Russia warns of such a planning by terrorists, but it is very important that Russia notes to such information, because terrorists are actually always trying to carry out such fabrications.
Okay, well, Robert, like Muhammad Ali said, I mean, it's not the first time that we are hearing this. I mean, it's amazing that after all these years, we're still seeing this similar M.O. Taking place. I mean, what is it going to take to actually stop these type of terrorist attack or false flag attacks to blame, once again, the Syrian government? I mean, how do we get past this?
We're not going to get past it for some time, because the United States plays right into it. You recall that during the Trump administration, there was such a false flag attack. Trump bombed Syria as a result of that, even though Secretary of State at that time said there was no evidence that the Syrian government was behind it. But as long as these terrorist groups, such as al-Nusra and the White Helmets, can continue to get the publicity that they want, which is the United States to back them and support them and give credence to their lies, to their false flag attacks, they will continue. It will take the international community to condemn not only the attacks themselves, but those countries, such as the United States, that are supporting the terrorists, that are encouraging the attacks by legitimizing them, and that are causing untold suffering to the Syrian people.
Let me just jump in here based on what you're saying. What is it going to take the international community to get involved? Well, let's talk about that, because, I mean, this has been going on since 2011, this onslaught on Syria. And what we have seen basically was the so-called international community continually calling for the legitimate president of Syria to step down and basically are supporting these attacks on a sovereign country. So where do we stand now? 10 years later, of course, we have the resistance front, and then we have what is called the international community. But really, there is nothing being done for Damascus from the so-called international community. So what's the answer? What needs to be done?
That's a very good question. The United States has to stop supporting terrorists around the world. This is the MO that the United States works for or operates under in order to further its geopolitical goals. this is not going to stop anytime soon. We do see some changes occasionally in different parts of the world and different attitudes that may be helpful. For example, in May, when Israel was bombing the Gaza Strip, there was widespread opposition around the world. This is the first time that's happened. And perhaps some governments were starting to take note of that. The same thing must happen for the Syrian people. People around the world, since governments won't act, people must force their governments to act by demonstrating in the streets, by voting out governments that will continually support war, continually support terrorism. And the United States is the largest sponsor of terrorism in the world, and that's not going to change under a Biden administration. But the key is going to have to be the people in a grassroots manner rising up in protest and demanding that their governments cease these injustices.
Okay. And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with us out of Damascus. Our very own Muhammad Ali and out of Kitchener, Ontario, Robert Fantina, author and journalist. Thanks so much, both of you, for being with us. And thank you for staying with us on another news review.
Cybersecurity firm Huntress Labs has revealed that a ransomware attack on a U.S. IT company potentially targeted 1,000 businesses. Huntress Labs says the massive operation was launched hours before the U.S. Independence Day holiday weekend. It said that the attack targeted a software supplied called Acacia in the state of Florida. The hack then spread through corporate networks using the software. Kaseya describes itself as a leading provider of IT and security management services to small and medium-sized businesses. Ransomware attacks typically involve locking away data and systems using encryption, making companies pay to regain access. A military plane carrying troops has crashed in the southern Philippines, killing at least 17 people. Military officials say the C-130 military transport aircraft with 92 people on board went down while trying to land on Jolo Island in Sulu Province. The aircraft flying from the southern city of Cagayan de Oro burst into flames when it missed the runway. So far, 40 people have been rescued and 17 bodies have been recovered from the burning wreckage. The death toll is expected to rise. Many of those on board were soldiers recently graduated from basic combat training. They were being deployed to the rest of island as part of a joint task force fighting terrorism. Rescue operations are underway in Japan after heavy rains triggered a massive landslide in a village in Shizuoka province, killing at least two people. Some 1,000 rescuers, including military personnel, are involved in the rescue operation. It is focused on finding 20 people who went missing in the central city of Atami. Torrents of mud crashed through parts of the town on Saturday morning, following days of heavy rains. Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga said an emergency cabinet meeting that up to 130 houses and other buildings have been damaged. Survivors have taken refuge in the evacuation center near the village. It comes after locals were put on alert as more rain lashed the area. Floods are common in Japan's rainy season.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding.
IRIB English Radio. On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
In the limelight.
Newly released records show that top Republicans in Arizona's largest county dodge calls from former President Donald Trump and his allies in the aftermath of the 2020 presidential election, as the then president sought to prevent the certification of Joe Biden's victory in key battleground states. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the Associated Press. The piece is titled, Arizona Republicans Face Pressure from Trump and Allies Following Election, Records Show. Newly released records showed that top Republicans in Arizona's largest county, Maricopa County, dodged calls from former President Donald Trump and his allies in the aftermath of the 2020 presidential election, as the then president sought to prevent the certification of Joe Biden's victory in key battleground states. The records from Arizona's largest county, Maricopa County, first obtained by the Arizona Republic, shed light on another state where Donald Trump, his attorneys, and others mounted a behind-the-scenes pressure campaign on Republican officials overseeing the elections. Days before Congress certified Joe Biden's win on 6th of January, Donald Trump pressed Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to find enough votes to overturn Joe Biden's win in that state. Donald Trump tried to reach Clint Hickman, then the chairman of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, on 3rd of January, shortly before midnight in Washington, and hours after news broke of Donald Trump's call with Raffensperger, the records show. "Hello, sir. This is the White House operator. I was calling to let you know that the president's available to take your call if you're free," the White House operator said in a voicemail. "If you could please give us a call back, sir, that would be great. You have a good evening." Clint Hickman told the Arizona Republic that he did not return the phone call. He said he presumed Donald Trump would try to pressure him to change election results or discuss election conspiracies, as he had done with Brad Raffensperger. "I'm not going to tape a president, so I'm not going to talk to a president. I didn't want to have a very rough call to my home on a Sunday night," Clint Hickman told the newspaper. Clint Hickman and the rest of the Board of Supervisors in Arizona, which is controlled 4-1 by Republicans, have aggressively defended the vote count in Maricopa County, which includes Phoenix and 60% of Arizona's voters. They have maintained the outcome was not affected by fraud or by irregularities. State Senate Republicans used their subpoena power to take control of all 2.1 million ballots and the machines that counted them. A firm led by a Trump supporter who had shared far-fetched conspiracy theories is overseeing an audit for the Senate GOP. The most aggressive pressure came from the Arizona Republican Party chairwoman, Kelly Ward, who tried to convince Republicans on the board to question the election results, even as the officials tried to instill confidence in them. At one point, she texted Clint Hickman, "We need you to stop the counting process." She tried to convince Clint Hickman and supervisors Steve Chokri and Bill Gates to call Trump attorney Sidney Powell, who filed lawsuits around the county alleging the election conspiracies. The lawsuits were all thrown out of court. Early on 20th of November, when the board was scheduled to certify Maricopa County's election results, Ward texted Gates, "Can we talk today now that the lawsuit is over? There are so many abnormalities that must be adjudicated. I know the Republican board doesn't want to be remembered as the entity who led the charge to certify a fraudulent election." After sending information alleging fraud, and shortly before the board voted to accept the election results, she texted him, "Sounds like your fellow Republicans are throwing in the towel. Very sad and very un-American." She texted Chukri, "Seems you're playing for the wrong team, and people will remember the wrong team." The records also include voicemails from Donald Trump's attorney Rudy Giuliani trying to reach several of the GOP supervisors. Chukri met with Giuliani when he was in Phoenix, Arizona, to air Donald Trump's baseless fraud theories. If you get a chance, you would please give me a call, Rudy Giuliani said in a message to Gates. I have a few things I'd like to talk over with you. Maybe we can get this thing fixed up. You know, I really think it's a shame that Republicans sort of are both in this kind of situation. And I think there may be a nice way to resolve this for everybody.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Communique.
The United States has launched one of the most outrageous attacks on the press and foreign media in recent times. Over 24 news outlets, including Press TV, had their .com domains seized and were completely taken offline. So why these websites? What do the vast majority of these news outlets have in common? Why were they targeted by the United States? And what does that say about a country that claims to champion so-called democracy and freedom of the press? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On June 23rd, 2021, the United States government seized the websites of several news broadcasters and media outlets belonging to Iran and its allies in one fell swoop. The websites targeted included Palestine Today, as well as Iran's Al Alam, which is an Arabic language broadcaster. They included Iraq's Al Furat and Yemen's Al Masira, just to name a few of the 33 outlets seized by the U.S. Among them was also this network, Press TV, where I myself have been proud to host my television program, The Communique, since late 2020. Anyone attempting to access PressTV.com is now met with a sign that reads, "This website has been seized," bearing the daunting seal of the U.S. Department of Justice and Department of Commerce. It's important to understand the U.S. government didn't just block these news sites inside the United States or in its own borders. It blocked them worldwide for everyone, rendering them inaccessible after seizing their .com domains. And of course, when we say seized, that's a nice way of saying stolen. This act here is very reminiscent of how the U.S. has also seized Iranian oil and sold it off like pirates, or seized Venezuela's gold, or seized Syria's oil fields. This is criminal behavior. It's piracy on the state level. Now, the next day, a statement was released by the U.S. Department of Justice confirming the seizure of not just Press TV's website, but a total of 33 outlets. That's 33 news sites who all had their websites taken down the same day. So the question here is, what do all these channels have in common? They're Muslim, they're Arabic, they're Persian, they're anti-imperialist, and they form part of the axis of resistance. To try and justify this blatant act of theft and suppression of the media, Joe Biden used the United States emergency laws. Yes, you heard that correctly. Joe Biden declared a national emergency under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which allows him to designate a, quote, unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security, foreign policy, or economy of the United States. Apparently, this television program and the programs and works of my colleagues are so upsetting that the U.S. feels the need to go activate its emergency laws just to silence us for speaking the truth. What the U.S. is doing here is outrageous. It's accusing foreign news outlets of being run by Iran's elite special forces and then using national emergency laws to silence them and calling that counterterrorism. The DOJ statement refers to sanctions imposed on Iran by former U.S. President Donald Trump in October 2020. Those sanctions specifically target the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, and the Islamic Radios and Televisions Union, IRTVU. And if you look at what they say, the Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC, claims absurdly and without any evidence that these news outlets are, quote, owned or controlled by the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, Quds Force, and also, quote, disguised as news organizations or media outlets targeting the United States with disinformation campaigns and malign influence operations. So they're making this outrageous claim that Press TV and other outlets are being run by the IRGC, and more specifically, the Quds Force. Now, as some of you may know, the Quds Force is an elite branch of the IRGC. It was formerly headed by General Qasem Soleimani. Donald Trump murdered Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi in January 2020. They were an incremental part in helping defeat Al-Qaeda and defeat Daesh in Syria and Iraq. Undoubtedly, the Quds Force plays a crucial role in the resistance front, but to claim that it's running these news outlets, this is absurd. Just to give you context, that's like saying that CNN is being run by the Navy SEALs or Delta Force. It's just not true. It doesn't make any sense. Now, typically, all websites that end in .com are managed by an American company called VeriSign. And apparently, because these news sites did not obtain a sanctions exemption, the U.S. thinks that it has the right to just shut them down. The United States claims jurisdiction over .com domains and has used that claim in the past to sue people overseas. But let's be clear here. This has nothing to do with sanctions exemptions or .com domains. First of all, the United States would have never even given a sanctions exemption in the first place, because these outlets tell the truth about foreign policy and about the United States and Israel and Great Britain. Second of all, if this was just about domains, why didn't the U.S. government go and shut down every single domain that is remotely connected to the IRGC or IRTVU? They didn't, because their goal here was to attack the media and shut down outlets that they don't like. This is an attack on the press. You can see clearly how there's practically no difference between Trump and Biden. Both of them make ridiculous accusations that these outlets are somehow running disinformation campaigns and being run by elite special forces. And then Biden goes ahead and uses sanctions that Trump created against Iran to seize the websites of Iranian broadcasters. The allegations leveled against them by the U.S. that they spread disinformation, they're no different from the ones that fueled the Russiagate scandal during the last 4 years. They're unproven. You might recall that Trump was heavily criticized by Democrats and the media for his, quote, unprecedented use and abuse of emergency powers and executive orders. He even declared a national emergency so he could secure funding for his border wall. Many, including Joe Biden, called Trump an existential threat and called him out for attacking the media. All right, so where's the accountability for Biden now that he is the president and he is abusing emergency powers to attack and silence the press? Where are all these Biden voters who claim that democracy was on the ballot and that fascism had to be voted out? Well, what do you call this? What do you call this attack on the media? How do you rationalize this behavior, accusing foreign journalists of being spies or special forces and then taking their sites down in the name of counterterrorism? Apparently, they don't seem to care much about authoritarianism under Biden. They don't mind it at all, because when the blue fascist attacks the press, then it's okay for them. Let's be clear about what this means here. By shutting down Press TV, the United States has decided of its own accord that 1.4 billion English-speaking people on the planet are no longer allowed to watch and listen to news that exposes imperialism and Zionism. This is way more than just authoritarianism. It would already be scandalous enough if the U.S. was blocking Press TV within its own borders, something it was already doing in many ways. But now the U.S. is deciding for the whole world what news they can consume and what foreign journalists can say. And equally, by abruptly shutting down broadcasters like Al Furat and Al Alam, along with others, they have created a huge vacuum in Arabic language media. When I began my career in journalism, this was late 2019, early 2020, on my YouTube channel and Twitter. I was very fortunate and blessed, alhamdulillah, to grow quickly and successfully, and I was offered my own television program right here on Press TV in the fall of 2020. But you see, I'm not from America. I don't work in America. Press TV is not based in America. So what gives the United States the right to seize my work and all the tireless work of my colleagues and just take it offline? What kind of behavior is that? For me, that's almost an entire year of weekly television broadcasts and episodes that I produced all gone. For others at Press TV and other outlets, it's even more. Now, thankfully, you can still access Press TV at our new domain. It's presstv.ir. But were it not for this backup, many of us would have lost all our work. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Now joining me from Tehran is American journalist, filmmaker, and host for Press TV, my wonderful colleague, Marcy Hashemi. Thank you so much for coming on the program. It's really great to have you, Marcy.
Hi, Richard. It's my pleasure to be with you. And you're doing a great job, by the way.
So I wanted to start out with this outrageous assault on the press from the other day when the United States took down Press TV's website and a bunch of other outlets as well. You know, I just want to ask you, first of all, what was going through your head? Like, what was your initial reaction? All this work, all these efforts that you and all our other colleagues have made just suddenly vanished and deleted off the internet.
Well, you know, Richard, unfortunately, I really wasn't surprised because we have seen so many assaults by various Western governments against Press TV. We have seen years ago, of course, in the early days of Press TV, we saw the satellites, the various satellites not allowing Press TV to be broadcast from them. We have seen, of course, like in the United States, we're never allowed on cable television. And in more recent years, we have seen the continual attacks on our social media, YouTube being blocked, so many different attacks. But this time around, perhaps I'm a little surprised, if I want to say anything, that it says how effective that we have been, how threatened they are by us, that they would actually seize the website. I mean, you know, Richard, before the U.S. was a little bit smoother with its censorship, with how it controls scenarios, but now we're just seeing outright attacks, and they're not even trying to hide their animosity and disdain anymore. And let me say, and lack of fair play and lack of believing in free speech and freedom of the press.
Yeah, I absolutely share your sentiment. And, you know, this is not the first time, obviously, that they've gone after Press TV. It's not just the website. It's also the social media pages. And I think you yourself have also been subjected to extremely cruel, inhumane treatment from the U.S. government. Could you maybe give the viewers an idea how far back this goes and why, even though we're angry, we're not surprised?
Right, yes, of course, I have had my own experience just 2 years ago, of course, being arrested in the U.S. And, you know, it's really interesting because after they arrested me and were asking questions about Press TV, it was mind-boggling for me as an American citizen in the United States, in the capital of the U.S., in Washington, D.C., that what was most important for them was why Press TV covered Israel in the way that it does. Asking several questions about basically why we don't show what they call the real perspective about Israel, why do we have negative coverage when it comes to Israel. What I found mind-boggling about that is that they asked me more questions about Press TV's coverage of Israel than Press TV's coverage of the United States, and I think that that says a lot. It's unfortunately the whole Zionist-controlled media right now in the U.S., and I would say Zionist-controlled government. And this is a big part of what is going on with us right now, let me say, because I really feel that the role that we've just played and other entities that have been seized by the United States, the role that was played in the most recent 11-day onslaught by the Israelis on the Gaza Strip, again, providing that alternative perspective. And of course, with social media now, you know, we had people, regular people in Sheikh Jarrah, in Gaza, at Al-Aqsa, and sending those videos and uploading it to social media. So then they no longer can control the narrative. And that's very difficult for them because they never play fairly. They at least though try to have that monopoly on it. And when they no longer can monopolize the narrative, that's when the situation will get really sticky and they will really play dirty, as we have seen with the seizure of our website and others. Well, of course, it was not the first time. It won't be the last time. But I think it says a lot. And I think, really, we actually all should sort of be proud that perhaps we're more effective than even we imagine ourselves, because, of course, we have lots of limitations because of the overall situation and being sanctioned. But at the same time, that they felt it was necessary to siege the website, I think that says a lot about how effective we have been. As I said earlier, it's not the first time, and I don't think that it will be the last time. And they will continually try to silence this resistance camp because actually we're showing an alternative perspective, the real perspective, with so many stories that before they had a monopoly on the narrative. So this is very difficult for them that they no longer have that monopoly. We have seen throughout the years various ways that the mainstream media tried to deal with that alternative perspective. And we have seen even, of course, unfortunately, sometimes them creating their own stories, their own scenarios, whether we're talking about in Iraq, 2003 leading up to that invasion by the U.S., or we're talking about even something like Douma, Syria, and we saw the whole thing that they created news. So, yeah, this is nothing new, and it's not going to stop, I'm sure.
Why do you think they decided to do this now? I've heard people speculate that perhaps this was in part due to the recent shift in public opinion in favor of Palestine, specifically after this onslaught against Gaza that we just saw in May. And of course, Press TV played a huge role in actually reporting about that accurately and truthfully. Do you think this shift in public opinion on the Israelis maybe played a small role? Because at the same time, as you mentioned, it does go a long way back. I also wanted to ask you, and I know this is kind of a rhetorical question, but are you surprised by the silence in the mainstream media, even in independent media, right? There are a lot of these so-called lefties who've said nothing at all.
Yeah, that's, you know, the unfortunate situation that we face, Richard, isn't it? That these so-called liberals definitely totally silent. When it comes to neoliberalism, I mean, because that's the real thing that we're talking about, really, and serving the 1%, right? When it comes to that, unfortunately, we don't see much of a difference between what is called the mainstream media and the so-called liberal media, because as we know, for example, we're talking about the United States, it really doesn't matter if there is an administration that is Democratic or Republican. Basically, they're serving the same elite and the 1%, and that's what we're looking at. Yeah, on the one hand, they want to call themselves liberal and open and woke. On the other hand, they remain silent when this obvious attack on liberties. The country that so, you know, really always talks about freedom of speech and freedom of the press and attacks so many countries for saying that they don't have it, we see what they have done and what they're doing. And it is absolutely amazing the silence that we're seeing coming from the mainstream media and the so-called liberal media. But again, unfortunately, we're not surprised because it's definitely not the first time that we've seen this.
We didn't only see Press TV being taken down. We also saw Al Furat, Al Masira. We saw 33 channels in total, all of them not just Iranian, some Yemeni, you know, Iraqi. So, I mean, what do these outlets have in common, though? Why were they targeted all together at once? What's the takeaway here?
Well, I think, what they have in common, that they basically, it's anti-hegemonic policies. We are seeing a full-force attack on the resistance front, and that's obvious because the resistance front has been effective. I think that we are seeing the United States and their Western allies, and even perhaps regional, some of their regional allies, reeling from losses. I mean, whether we're talking about, for example, the Daesh project was a major project, and it failed for the most part in Syria and in Iraq. And why did it fail? Because of resistance. And the media connected with, for example, resistance, whether we're talking about in Iraq or whether we're talking about in Syria, whether we're talking about in Palestine or Yemen or the Islamic Republic of Iran, standing up against these hegemonic and demonic policies that they have tried to implement. So again, wanting to control the narrative and no longer being able to do that. We look at what is going on in Yemen, the amount of the type of weapons and equipment that have been sold to Saudi Arabia by the United States, by the UK, and of course their support for the Saudi regime in their onslaught on the Yemeni people. And yet we have seen unbelievable advances on the ground by freedom fighters, the Yemeni people. And of course, being that the media connected with that, trying to show the reality, again, they don't want the other side, the reality of that narrative to be shown. As I said, you know, we've seen this a lot. We have seen this a lot, and this is why we're going to continue to see the attacks that we have, and at the same time, we're going to continue doing what we do.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. It's horrific what's happening in Yemen. And, you know, just to wrap up, Marcy, I see the United States just yesterday complaining that media outlets have been censored in Hong Kong, and they point the finger at China and Russia and Iran and a host of other countries, calling them authoritarian. But, I mean, what they've done now, the U.S. just taking down the websites, shutting down 33 foreign news outlets, I mean, is that not clearly an attack on the press? I don't think I could ever listen. I already couldn't ever listen again to another Western country lecturing about press freedoms. Can you, can anyone?
Yeah, well, you know, I haven't been able to for a long time, Richard. My experience with the Western press goes way back. Of course, I was an American-educated journalist, universities in the United States. So I've learned early about the techniques that they use, but let me just say, there's been a major deterioration in the United States dealing with the press. At one time, we really did have more of an independent press. I mean, we can look at history and see, for example, during the Vietnam War, one of the main catalysts for people taking to the streets mass demonstrations and protests were the body bags, the number of body bags, coffins that were coming back to the United States, the number of American soldiers who had been killed. And we know that, for example, in 2003, with the start of the U.S. Invasion of Iraq, that they made it illegal for journalists to take photographs, to take pictures or videos and show the body bags. So I think we're seeing a very, very different reality on the ground of journalists now, journalism now there. Post-2001, is a totally different world in the world of journalism in the West. And unfortunately, it has gotten so authoritarian as far as the government itself, and it's trying to control alternative narratives. So yes, we have seen definite deterioration. And yeah, it's like the pot calling the kettle black. So, you know, they're pointing the finger at Hong Kong or China or Iran. And really, it is unbelievable the techniques that they are using to control the narrative. And I ask anyone, I mean, if it was something that, for example, the opposite had happened, like in China or in Iran, that they had totally sieged a foreign website, and I mean, what would be the reaction? So, yes, we're continually seeing this hypocrisy coming out of Washington and coming from the mainstream media, but as I said earlier, we will continue doing what we do and hopefully being the voice of the voiceless.
We constantly hear Britain and America and their allies whining and complaining about China, about Russia, about Iran, accusing them of being authoritarian and attacking the press. Every day, some Western reporter thinks they're very tough for yelling Navalny's name at Russian President Putin. But of course, not a word about Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, journalist whose extradition hearing I covered. They say nothing about Assange, who Trump and now Biden are trying to extradite to the U.S., threatening him with 175 years in jail as he's locked in a maximum security prison in London. Just imagine for a second if Iran had gone and permanently seized the websites of Western outlets like the BBC or CNN. Just imagine the outrage that would ensue. So where is the outrage now when the United States shuts down 33 foreign news sites? Where is the outrage at this violent behavior, this criminal attack against the press? How do people just let the U.S. get away with this outrageous behavior, purposely going and silencing adversarial outlets that are not even inside the U.S.? Of course the media says nothing. Of course. And even many in the so-called American left, in independent media, will say nothing because they're afraid to defend Arabic, Persian, and Muslim outlets, or what Israeli media laughably calls pro-Hamas outlets, as if that's all they are. These so-called leftists and defenders of free speech have vanished. They have nothing to say all of a sudden about Biden using emergency laws to shut down foreign media outlets like some dictator. When it comes to imperialism, you really get to see their true colors. You really get to see where they stand. What the U.S. has done here against Press TV and other outlets is outrageous and despicable. It's an attack on the press. It's an attack on foreign journalists. Let's be unequivocal about that. This is an extraterritorialization of U.S. law and authoritarianism. But you know, at the very least, it shows, it proves that our work is effective and important, and that they are afraid of us because we speak the truth. And if they want to come and call journalists a, quote, unusual and extraordinary threat because we stand up for Palestinians and we expose the true nature of America's foreign policy, then we'll take that as a badge of honor. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
The limelight. Zionist regime officers wounded the detainees, terrorized them, and whomever dared to lift his head upwards risked more beatings by officers. According to affidavits, the floor of the room was covered in blood from the beatings. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Boxbaum Ryder. This article is published under the heading Palestinian protesters recount harrowing details of torture at the hands of Israeli regime police. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. In May, the world watched the Zionist regime's brutal occupation on full display. The forcible displacement of Sheikh Jarrah residence was underway. The Zionist regime's security forces attacked Muslim worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan. The Israeli regime rocket fire rained down on Gaza, and Jewish extremists chanted death to Arabs in the streets. According to multiple testimonies, the Zionist regime police in Nazareth ran a torture room where they ruthlessly attacked Palestinian detainees during the wave of demonstrations against the Zionist regime in May. Now, as international headlines fade on Palestine, the Israeli regime violence continues. Faiz Zobedat was talking on the phone about 20 feet away from a protest in Nazareth. The moment the 21-year-old student hung up the phone, the Israeli regime police threw a stun grenade into the street. An officer then charged at him and punched him in the nose. Zobedat was soon encircled by police who grabbed him, hit him, and pushed him toward a border police officer who tried to slam his head against a wall. I asked why they were hitting me when I am not resisting, Zobedat said, adding, I put my hands behind my back even though they didn't handcuff me. Nevertheless, the same border police officer hit me in the nose with the walkie-talkie that he was holding. The officers dragged Zubaydah by his head to the police station, beating him along the way. On the way, we met a policeman who appeared to be an officer and started laughing and said to them, "Did you only arrest him? That's not enough. We need more," Zubaydah said. The beating continued inside the police station. Cops kicked, slapped, and hit detainees with batons, laughing as they struck them. Zubaydah detailed how one officer smacked detainees with an M16 rifle. He watched as one man with a broken nose, face covered in blood, was continuously hit by officers. Then Zubaydah described his own treatment. A police officer approached me and whispered in my ear, threatening me. He cursed my mother, my sister, and my wife. He then asked, "Did you understand?" I didn't answer, and he immediately slapped me in the face. He asked me again, "Do you understand?" I still didn't answer, and he slapped me again in the face. Finally, he said, "Go explain to your friends." He pushed me back down to the floor and hit me again. Zubaydah's violent detention in May is one of many such, according to Adala, the legal center for Arab minority rights in the occupied territories. The advocacy group collected multiple sworn affidavits attesting to the abuse of Palestinian protesters by the Zionist regime officers, attorneys, bystanders, and children inside Nazareth police station from May 9th to May 14th. The majority of the violent arrests and most of the abuse were conducted by the Zionist regime special forces, including undercover Mista Varim.